Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. For the next 60 minutes, you can hear many of the top stories presented on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Parliamentary elections in Afghanistan were extended to a second day last Sunday, giving people who were not able to cast a ballot Saturday another opportunity. Election officials said 3 million people voted on Saturday, but there were challenges, including polling stations that never opened and technical problems with voting equipment. At least 15 people were killed in attacks on voters and polling stations, and scores of people were injured. The Taliban had issued repeated warnings that they would attack polling stations and all election-related activity. The threats, however, were not enough to keep registered voters at home. The final results won't be known for weeks. Afghanistan has a long history of problems when elections are held. I talked about the situation there with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center.
Unfortunately, in Afghanistan, there's always violence on election day. And certainly this time around was no exception. The Taliban had threatened to disrupt the elections, and there were quite a few reported attacks. And of course, as we know, in recent days, there was an assassination of General Razak, who was the most powerful figure in southern Afghanistan. And in response, Kabul decided to postpone voting for a week. So, you know, unfortunately, you had a lot of cases of violence. You also had cases of voters showing up at the polling station only to find that their names weren't on voting lists, or that there was just a lot of disorganization or even chaos at polling stations. And I think that's unfortunate, too. You have all these people that came out to vote. They braved Taliban threats, and yet they found that their governing authorities had not taken sufficient measures to allow them to vote. And that certainly is disconcerting.
What is your overall view of so many people turning out, and where does it go from here?
You know, let's remember that these elections, many people didn't expect them to happen at all. You know, they had already been delayed twice. And the fact that they actually happened, I think that's a triumph. That's a victory for Afghanistan in of itself, and a defeat for the Taliban, which had vowed to disrupt them as much as possible and had told people not to vote in them. So that's a good thing. But certainly, you know, moving forward, I think that there's a lot of reason to be concerned about political stability in Afghanistan. I imagine that the many critics of the government in Kabul will use this, what will certainly be seen as a flawed election, as ammunition to escalate their criticism and pressure on the government in Kabul, which is already quite beleaguered and only a few months away from theoretically hosting a presidential election to see what the next top leadership in Afghanistan is going to look like. So it's going to be a pretty tense, I mean, as if things weren't already tense in Afghanistan, it's going to be a pretty tense few months, thanks in great part to these elections, which, you know, despite their happening, which is a good thing, will cause a lot of concerns and questions about legitimacy and credibility, which, you know, all these critics of the government in Afghanistan will just jump on and apply constant pressure on this administration.
You said that over the weekend, the election caused a little setback for the Taliban. But what is the strength of the Taliban and other insurgent groups in Afghanistan now?
Well, I mean, let's be very clear that the Taliban now controls more territory in Afghanistan than at any time since 2001 when U.S. troops entered. So that's a pretty clear indicator of its strength. And also, what's quite alarming, I mean, setting aside the territorial control issue, I mean, the Taliban basically it has impunity. It can attack at will, or it can attack whenever and wherever it wants. It stages attacks regularly in supposedly highly secure areas. Again, the most powerful man in southern Afghanistan, General Abdul Razak, was assassinated, apparently by his own guards who were working for the Taliban. So I think it's all very sobering. The U.S. forces have been in Afghanistan for 17 years. Initially, the Taliban had areas of strength in the south near the Pakistan border. But now it's got a pretty nationally entrenched presence, areas to the west and far to the north, where until relatively recent years, it didn't really have much influence at all.
And what about other groups such as ISIS and even other groups such as China and Russia? Where do they fit into all this?
ISIS remains resilient. It continues to stage attacks. It doesn't have a huge number of fighters. The figures used to be in several thousands, now several hundred. But, you know, they're able to stage attacks, including in Kabul. And then you look at other players at the nation states. So very complicated state of affairs. The bottom line is that the war that the U.S. has tried to figure out a way to win in Afghanistan is not any closer to being won, while at the same time, some of America's top strategic rivals are making inroads in Afghanistan, deepening their footprint. So all in all, it's a bit of a mess.
The last few months in Afghanistan have been marred by election-related violence. 10 candidates have died in various attacks across the country, along with dozens of their supporters, since the beginning of the nomination period in late May. The government responded to the security concerns by deploying 70,000 security personnel around the country to safeguard 5,100 polling stations. Australia's centre-right government has lost its one-seat majority in Parliament following a defeat in a by-election in Sydney. The ballot was prompted by the removal of Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister in a party-room coup. Phil Mercer has more for us from Sydney.
The defeat of the governing Liberal Party candidate is seen by analysts as an act of retribution by Sydney voters, furious at the way their former MP Malcolm Turnbull was ousted as Prime Minister. He was forced out by government colleagues in August, and he then resigned as an MP. For the first time ever, the seat of Wentworth isn't in Conservative hands. It'll be represented by Karen Phelps, a local doctor and prominent gay rights campaigner. She accused the government of ignoring voters and of doing too little to address the impact of climate change. She was given little chance of winning when the campaign began, but she's savouring her famous achievements.
People have been concerned about the direction of government for a very long time, and we've seen a lack of decency, a lack of integrity, and we really need to go back to looking at what the House of Representatives is all about. It's about representing the people, and the people have spoken loud and clear.
This is the biggest by-election swing against a federal government ever recorded in Australia. It strips the centre-right Prime Minister Scott Morrison of his narrow one-seat parliamentary majority in the lower house of parliament. He accepts blame for the defeat, but says he will fight on.
The result today is on us, the Liberals. But leadership requires you to turn up on the tough days and the good days, and that's what you'll always get from me as the leader of the Liberal Party.
The Morrison government will probably survive for now with the support of independent MPs. But with a federal election due next May, its longer-term prospects appear grim. There is speculation that the government's grip on power is so tenuous that an early poll is considered in certain quarters to be inevitable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A dissident Vietnamese blogger imprisoned for defaming the country's communist government was celebrating her first days of freedom this past week on U.S. soil. VOA's Marcus Harton had the story.
Nguyen Ngoc Nhu Quyen arrived in Houston early Thursday morning, accompanied by her two young children and her mother.
I'm still in shock, despite the fact that I had a little time to prepare myself mentally to unite with my family. I can't describe the feeling when my children hugged me on the airplane. We waited 2 years for this moment.
Quyen, who blogged under the pseudonym Mother Mushroom, wrote extensively about human rights and industrial pollution before she was arrested in October 2016 and sentenced to 10 years in prison.
They blocked all information and all contacts until the moment I was at the airport. That's why my son couldn't contain his feeling. Our reunion on board today is the message to the Vietnamese government that I'm not alone, and being a person with freedom of speech is not as lonely as they think.
Quyen said she came to the U.S. because no one cares more about human rights than the United States. She is among dozens of bloggers and activists who have been arrested since 2016 as part of the Vietnamese government's crackdown on dissent over the past 2 years. Marcus Harton, VOA News, Washington.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. Carpentry is traditionally considered a man's job in Pakistan, but a few brave women are changing that mindset. From carving unique wooden utensils to building an entire house. VOA spoke with several women who wanted to hammer home the point that not only are women integral to their community and the economy, they can also build things as well as men. This report, produced in the remote Hunza Valley in northern Pakistan by VOA's Urdu service, tells their story. It's narrated by Benson Hamdard.
My name is Amna, and I work in carpentry.
My name is Amna. I am working as a carpenter. I am the master carpenter here. My friend Gulshan and I started this back in 2008, and now there are 43 women in our carpentry group.
The Agha Khan Development Network in Pakistan, a non-profit organization known for community development, started this project 10 years ago to make women more self-sufficient. And in a country where men are often the sole breadwinners, more than 100 women have now been trained to work in various fields, including carpentry.
It felt strange at first, holding a saw and other tools. It seemed very difficult, but once we got used to it, we liked it. We thought we would never leave this field. Soon after, many other women joined too.
Many of these women did not finish their education, but some have now become skilled carpenters. One told us she's supporting her family while doing what she loves.
My dad passed away a long time ago. I really wanted to get an education, but I did not have resources to complete it. I thought I should not only support myself, but my family too.
Carpentry is considered a man's work in Pakistan, and women are often discouraged from doing it.
At first, it was difficult for us to do this kind of job, given our societal mindset. It was not acceptable for a woman to do a man's job. People would say, why don't you learn sewing or knitting or become a teacher?
But Farman Bibi didn't want to sew or knit or teach. She had other plans. She's earning enough now to complete her education and still help her family.
We had many financial issues, which is the reason why I joined. Now I support the household and am completing my education. I helped my younger sister get her master's degree and helped my brother with his schooling.
In many countries around the world, women are already crucial contributors to a healthy economy. Despite the challenges they face, Aguila says it is time for Pakistani women to do the same.
Wherever women go, they face issues that will affect their honor, religion, culture, and social norms. However, when they step out and do something in order to take care of their family, then they realize that their honor, religion, culture, and everything is still in place.
Others say the biggest hurdle for women in Pakistan is the lack of freedom to make their own decisions.
Political and religious leaders often come to lecture us on what women should do. They never allow us the opportunity to think in terms of what we want as women.
Amna and her peers have become trailblazers in their own country. And they told VOA that they are determined and eager to help other Pakistani women understand that not only is it possible for a woman to be self-reliant, it's also good for the financial health of their families. For VOA's Urdu service, this is Bejan Hamdan, VOA News.
The United States and dozens of other countries have pledged to work together to tackle the illegal wildlife trade and treat it as a serious crime following a conference in London. Trade in endangered wildlife such as elephant tusks, rhino horns, and tiger bones is worth an estimated $17 billion a year, and it's pushing hundreds of species to the brink of extinction. Henry Ridgewell had the story on the recently held conference.
Training day for officers on the front line. Border guards and wildlife officials from Kenya and Tanzania are being taught to identify animal parts, which are often disguised or concealed in cargo or vehicles. All of these items were confiscated by the Kenya Wildlife Service. There's much work to do.
Only 50% of those that are convened here for this training this week could recognize elephant ivory. Only one of our 40 participants could recognize pangolin scales.
Such stark gaps in the global fight against the illegal wildlife trade were top of the agenda at the London conference. Speaking to several heads of state from across the world, Britain's Prince William, a passionate conservationist, said he recognised that law enforcement resources are already stretched.
But I am asking you to see the connections, to acknowledge that the steps you take to tackle illegal wildlife crime could make it easier to halt the shipments of guns and drugs passing through your borders.
It is an industry that is booming. Illegal ivory trade activity has more than doubled since 2007. Over 1,300 rhino were killed in 2015 alone. Asian tigers have seen a 95% decline in population. In the last year, more than 100 rangers have died in their line of work. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said that Washington would give $90 million to programs that fight illegal wildlife traffickers.
Their criminal acts harm communities, degrade institutions, destabilize our environment, and funnel billions of dollars to those who perpetuate evil in the world.
It's not just big mammals at risk. Peruvian authorities say over 12,000 critically endangered frogs have been taken from Lake Titicaca in the last 5 years to make a juice that some believe has medicinal properties, despite no scientific evidence. But it's not all bad news. At the beginning of this year, China closed its domestic ivory market.
This market was both stimulating demand for ivory and also enabling illegal ivory to be laundered through this legal trade. But that same issue still exists for big cats. There's a trade in leopard bone products, large-scale commercial trade.
White says existing UN conventions already offer firepower for tackling the illegal wildlife trade, but they are not being used effectively. In the closing declaration, conference attendees pledged to work together to tackle the illegal wildlife trade as a serious and organised crime. Campaigners say the real test is how quickly they will act on those words. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the London Conference on the Illegal Wildlife Trade.
Scientists say the issue of climate change and global warming is becoming more pressing as news comes in about melting permafrost and rising sea levels. Scientists have begun urging people across the globe to reduce emissions of climate-warming carbon. But the Salk Institute in San Diego, California, is taking a different approach. There, scientists are working on developing plants that would not only capture more carbon than plants do now, but also store it away for centuries, preventing it from being released back into the atmosphere. Gina Dulot releases the rest of the story to us now.
In photosynthesis, plants use the energy in sunlight to absorb carbon dioxide from the air and combine it with water to create sugars to use for growth. In the process, they release oxygen and store the carbon in their tissues, including the roots. It's gradually released as the plants grow and when they die and decay. But some carbon stays in the soil. This inspired scientists from the Salk Institute in San Diego, California, to program plants to make more stable forms of carbon, which would be stored long-term deep in the soil.
When I was a child growing up in western Pennsylvania, I was an avid gardener. My grandmother and great-grandmother taught me to have a vegetable garden every summer. And I do remember from my childhood trying to put cork, because I knew it was a natural substance, like wood, but a slightly different form. I put it in my compost heaps and it never decayed.
Cork contains a high level of suberin, a waterproof waxy substance found in most plants that prevents roots from decomposing. It's this quality that scientists hope to use to keep carbon buried underground and, well, to save the world.
By leaving some plant carbon behind in the soil, the plants actually grow better. So an ecosystem or a farmer's field, etc., that has a higher carbon content in the soil is a healthier environment.
Today, scientists are working to create mechanisms that would allow plants to produce more suberin. Salk Institute labs imitate various climate zones to find a perfect plant for each region. This process takes time and energy. Recently, the Institute purchased a robot that in one day does more than a team of scientists can accomplish in 5 weeks. They're using conventional breeding to create crops that are carbon storage powerhouses, but may one day use genetic engineering.
We use the natural variation, the natural genetic variation that exists in natural strains to increase the amounts of Cerberin, so we are not necessarily in need to use genetic engineering. However, if we were to use genetic engineering, it would be much faster.
In the next 5 years, the scientists plan to have an array of plants for different regions that would help lower level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The effect wouldn't be felt for another decade or two, but the scientists say they hope by then humanity will have figured out how to slow down climate change. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, San Diego, California.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton met last Monday with top Russian officials about President Donald Trump's announced intention to pull out of a key Cold War arms deal with Moscow. Bolton discussed the fate of the three-decade-old INF, or Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, with the Russian Security Council chief ahead of a meeting with the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. Bolton was set to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday. President Donald Trump announced on Saturday the decision to pull out of the treaty, citing what he claimed was Russia's building and testing missiles that violate the 1987 treaty. In March, Navy Admiral Harry Harris, who was then commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that China was benefiting because of the United States' adherence to the INF. He was questioned by Senator Tom Cotton.
How many of China's land-based missile forces do you estimate have a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers?
In an unclassified venue, Senator, over 90%. Over 90% fall in that range.
And how many missiles do you have that fall into that range?
I have none, sir.
You have none?
Right.
Why do you have none?
Because that range, 500 to 5,500 kilometers, is defined in the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty, which prohibits nuclear and cruise missiles and ICBMs, or nuclear and conventional cruise and ICBMs, or ballistic missiles in that range. And we adhere to the INF Treaty religiously, as we should. It's a treaty that we signed on for. China is not a signatory to the treaty, so they're not obliged to follow that treaty, and we can't legitimately, in my opinion, criticize China for developing weapons that contravene the treaty because they did not sign on to it.
Because the only two parties to the treaty are Russia and the United States.
That's correct.
Could the inability to match China's missile force be reason enough for the United States to pull out of the INF? Anki Panda of the Federation of American Scientists, an expert in missile defense and nuclear issues in Asia, told me that is one of the reasons the pullout might take place.
The reason I find it unconvincing, or at least unconvincing so far without further debate, is because, first of all, it's not necessarily the case that the United States needs to mirror image Chinese capabilities to successfully deter China. I do care about deterring China, but I don't necessarily think that we need to have exactly the kind of ballistic and cruise missile arsenal that they do, in particular because the kind of geography we're dealing with in East Asia is quite different from the geography of Western Europe, where ground launch missiles in Central Europe and Western Europe played a critical role through the early 1980s in deterring the Soviet Union. In Asia, we're dealing with primarily a maritime domain where there are very few actual chunks of land in allied countries. Guam is probably the closest U.S. territory where these weapons could be deployed. But apart from that, looking at specific U.S. allies and partners, it's not clear to me that, A, the kind of territory that exists would be particularly useful for those kinds of deployments, and B, there's a complicated issue of allied politics here. You know, we think about a place like Okinawa, and we think about potential ballistic missile deployments there or cruise missile deployments there, even conventional weaponry. I'm not even talking about nuclear weaponry. It's not clear to me that allied populations would be willing to host U.S. Missiles on their soil.
Why is it that China is putting up such a vociferous complaint against pulling out of the treaty?
China does see this as an attempt by the United States to work towards containing it. The reason that China's arsenal looks the way it does is not entirely to do with the United States, although that's certainly a big part of it. China also borders India, where a lot of those INF range missiles that it deploys do play a role in deterring New Delhi. India is also a nuclear power in this context, so China does have concerns there. But otherwise, China's nuclear arsenal remains particularly lean, and the Chinese do see this as a play by the United States to effectively counter its fairly lean deployment. I think while we do see the Chinese protesting right now, I think in 5 to 10 years' time, if this does play out the way I think it will, and the United States will develop new INF range capabilities and deploy them in East Asia, I think we will see changes in China's own posture, potentially China building considerably a greater number of missiles and potentially even making some subtle changes to its nuclear doctrine.
Conjecture has it that what the Trump administration wants to do is what it has done in many other areas, and that is blow up. That's a bad use of terminology, but nevertheless, to blow up what exists and then rebuild. And that what he would like is a similar treaty to the INF, but one that includes China. Have you heard that? Is that a possibility?
That, I agree, would be the ideal solution, would be to bring China into the INF arrangement. That simply won't happen, given the investments that the Chinese have made. And this would not be a treaty discussion that they would have been a part of from the beginning. This is a 1987 agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union, and China at the time had no role or no consideration in the minds of the Soviet Union or the United States in negotiating the treaty. So while that would be ideal, I do think it's fairly unrealistic.
Defense advocates in Washington say the INF treaty keeps the United States from developing a new generation of weapons in a world that faces new global security challenges. Trump said we'll have to develop those weapons unless Russia comes to us and China comes to us and they all come to us and say let's really get smart and let none of us develop those weapons. But if Russia's doing it and if China's doing it and we're adhering to the agreement, that is unacceptable. China's defense ministry Thursday said it found the meeting last week between Defense Minister Wei Feng and U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis in Singapore constructive. In those talks on the sidelines of a regional defense forum, Mattis called for deepening bilateral contacts to ease tensions and avoid inadvertent conflict. However, at a security meeting in Beijing Thursday, Wei denounced recent remarks by Vice President Mike Pence, who charged China with interfering in America's electoral process. He said it severely undermined relations, mutual trust, and cooperation. He said the Taiwan issue is a matter of China's sovereignty and territorial integrity, a core interest. He said it is extremely dangerous to challenge China's bottom line. He said trying to separate China from Taiwan will be met with resolute military action, and China will pay any price that has to be paid. He also maintained that the islands of the South China Sea have long been Chinese territory, and defense facilities there are a matter of self-defense, not militarization. At the Warsaw Security Forum in Poland Wednesday, retired U.S. Lieutenant General Ben Hodges raised eyebrows by predicting conflict with China as a very strong likelihood. But he also said it was not inevitable. Hodges cited a recent near miss between an American and Chinese warship in the South China Sea, trade tensions, intellectual property theft, and China's expansive infrastructure spending. Brad Glosserman, a visiting professor at the Tokyo-based Tama University Center for Rulemaking Strategy, told VOA's Victor Beatty this was a message aimed primarily at Europe.
He's really trying to prod them to do more in their own defense and just remind them that U.S. has eyes on a number of theaters and that it's probably, and perhaps rightfully, more concerned about the potential for conflict in the Pacific. And if you spend any time in Europe, as I have several times this year, you realize China is a very, very distant place and distant challenge, not even threat yet. So I think that's probably the most important way to start. You know, it presumes that China continues on the trajectory that it's on and that given the sense of conflict that's coming, that we don't do anything about changing that, about changing Chinese behavior and about building ways to dampen potential sources of conflict. What this is this notion of this Thucydides trap, right? This idea that rising powers invariably triggered conflict with established status quo powers. And I'm extremely skeptical of that. And again, mostly because I just don't believe that in over a 15-year time period, we can't get in front of this problem, even though the general is right to note that accidents do happen.
We do have a more, what's being described often in news reports, assertive China, particularly in the South China Sea. You had that incident of a near miss between two warships, one American and one Chinese, just a couple of weeks ago.
Right. And like I said, accidents do happen. We've begun conversations with the Chinese about coming up with codes of conduct and ways for military vessels and militaries to interact in areas like this. You know, and we've had accidents like this before. If you go back to 2001, when our two planes collided in the South China Sea as well. So this is not unusual. And sometimes what you need is a sobering incident, precisely like the one that occurred a few weeks ago, to remind everyone of the stakes involved. And I think that for all of the shortcomings of the Chinese leadership, I think they understand that a war is certainly not in their interest. And the Chinese are maybe expansionist in design, but certainly not reckless in practice.
Is the South China Sea the likely point of conflict, or could you see it elsewhere?
That's where you have the greatest potential and the highest amount of friction. But one could easily see just as well something erupting in the East China Sea, where the Chinese and the Japanese have a conflict over the Senkaku Islands. Or, in fact, you could see it on the Korean Peninsula as well, where the rapprochement between the United States and North Korea and North Korea and South Korea could easily go off the rails. South China Sea could well be the most likely, but I wouldn't underestimate the potential for something in the East China Sea, too. And, of course, Taiwan.
Brad Glosserman said there is a growing frustration in Beijing over the lack of progress on its unification agenda with Taiwan, where there is growing sentiment to maintain the status quo, not reunification. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is in China this Thursday seeking better relations with China. A trade official from Indonesia says his country and China are forging closer economic ties as those two countries face threats to their trade relations with the United States. China says it has 24 FTAs, or free trade agreements, under construction, among which 16 agreements have been signed and implemented already. This seemingly is a direct reaction to the trade war between Beijing and Washington. We welcome to VOA Asia Joseph Foudy, professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at New York University. Professor, welcome. What do the Chinese want to accomplish with these agreements?
Well, they're trying to increase their leverage in any future negotiations with the United States, showing the U.S. that there are other parties that they can work with. And it's the same strategy on the other side, since at this point, you know, everybody has to worry about incurring sort of the wrath of the Trump administration.
How has this wrath, that's your explanation of it, how has this wrath and these policies that the Trump administration have taken affected, let's take, as far as business is concerned, worldwide standing?
Well, it's hurt the U.S. reputation in the world, but it's important to understand at this point it's mostly rhetoric and there's been comparatively few U.S. actions. But if there's one country that seems to anticipate that there actually will be, you know, large-scale tariffs enacted, it seems to be China.
So what does this mean as far as the way the structure is set up? For many a decade now, the U.S. has been the economic leader, still the biggest economic power in the world. Has this changed the thrust of this?
Yeah, the U.S. has always had trade tensions before, particularly with allies. But, you know, the current rhetoric coming out of Washington really is that the United States will no longer put foreign policy concerns ahead of trade concerns. And that's relatively new.
What do you think the Trump administration's goal is here? What do they expect to accomplish?
Well, they're hoping to rewrite as many treaties as possible to sort of increase U.S. exports. From an economic perspective, that's problematic because we tend to believe that most of the U.S. trade deficit is really caused by a sort of a lack of domestic savings in the U.S. But the Trump administration believes that if it can negotiate one-on-one with most countries, it'll maximize U.S. leverage.
Does that hold any validity as far as you're concerned?
I think on the margins, you'll see the U.S. is able to extract concessions. You can look at the recent deal with Mexico and Canada. But I don't think any of these treaties will be that significant. Now, the one country where you really could see trade disputes move the needle is China, and that's in part why you already see companies putting out profit warnings for next year in the U.S.
How is this all going to work out? What's your prediction?
I think it's quite likely that the U.S. and China are not going to be able to find a deal, and we will see tariffs enacted at this point.
And what does that lead to?
I think that'll just lead to sort of a series of tit-for-tats. It, on the margins, will hurt both economies, though trade between the two countries is not that big of a driver. In the U.S. case, we're a relatively large country, and China is only one piece of our trade. The Chinese economy today is much more internally focused than it was 10 or 20 years ago, but it'll certainly have negative impacts on growth for both countries.
Joseph Fowdy is professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at New York University. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Farmers in the American Midwest are working the fields this fall amid a trade dispute between the United States and China, once one of the largest importers of U.S. corn and soybeans. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, uncertainty looms over how it will ultimately affect farm income this year, as growers have yet to feel the full impact or benefits of the escalating trade picture.
Among the mounting concerns, Illinois farmer Bob Gerke is juggling. He is racing against the clock to harvest his corn and soybeans. Bob spends up to 14 hours a day in the fields.
Biggest concern right now we're harvesting that we don't get stuck and we get the crops out before Mother Nature throws snow at us.
But his worries don't end there.
The marketer's advice even this spring never was calling for soybeans to go down this extreme, but they weren't thinking there was going to be a tariff.
Bob is talking about Chinese tariffs on U.S. grain products, a retaliatory move after the United States slapped tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. It's brought down soybean prices as much as $2 this year.
That's a big deal for a farmer who's counting on that yield and that farm income.
Tamara Nelson, Senior Director of Commodities for the Illinois Farm Bureau, is concerned.
This is a fifth straight year of lower farm income. I think the second lowest farm income since 2012.
Nelson says news of a pending trade agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada to replace NAFTA so far isn't doing much to put farmers at ease.
Whether or not that was achieved because of the tariff threats remains to be seen, because the steel and aluminum tariffs still remain on Mexico and Canada, and their retaliatory tariffs threatened against us still remain.
Farmer Bob Gerke had hoped decades of negotiations and relationships in China would be paying off, reversing declining farm income by keeping one of the largest markets for U.S. soybeans open.
And we've built trade up to where it was working. And now within a matter of 6 months, a lot of that has been knocked down, maybe even devastated, to where will it come back? How long it's going to take to come back?
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's $12 billion aid package was supposed to be a silver lining while it helps offset his lower soybean prices.
They're saying that we would get, I believe it's $1.60 or $1.65 a bushel.
Gerke says it doesn't help his corn.
It's a penny. Well, why even bother if you're going to give us a penny? That's more paperwork than it's worth. And then in their package, what they present, $200 million is for market development. It's like, we had the market. That's sort of a joke.
Soybeans are still being sold around the world, even if they might not be going to China. Sales to Europe and Argentina are up this year. So the question remains, are the trade tactics adopted by President Trump and his administration ultimately working?
That's probably the $64,000 question.
I think if you ask most farmers right now, they'll say no. You ask them maybe a year from now, 6 months from now, it might change their mind.
6 months from now, Gerke himself will be in a very different mindset, shifting gears from harvesting his crops to planting seeds in the ground for a new growing season, a season he hopes is filled with more certainty. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Elgin, Illinois.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Australia's Prime Minister has delivered an historic national apology to all victims and survivors of institutional child sexual abuse. It follows a damning 5-year inquiry into abuse across churches, schools, and other public organizations, as we hear from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said he's sorry for one of the most shameful chapters in Australian history. A royal commission, Australia's highest form of inquiry, found that tens of thousands of children had been abused over many decades in orphanages, churches, schools and other institutions. Its report published last year said too often the victims were ignored and the perpetrators protected. Morrison told Parliament Monday that it was a national tragedy.
Silenced voices, muffled cries in the darkness, unacknowledged tears, the tyranny of invisible suffering, the never-heard pleas of tortured souls bewildered by an indifference to the unthinkable theft of their innocence. Today, Australia confronts a trauma, an abomination.
Survivors of abuse have welcomed Australia's official apology, but many stress that much more needs to be done to heal their scars, including a less bureaucratic system of compensation and changes to the law to punish those who conceal abuse. Victims are eligible to apply for payments of up to $106,000. Although there are complaints, the redress scheme is too slow. The Prime Minister also promised to set up a new national museum to raise awareness and understanding of the impacts of child sexual abuse. It will also memorialise victims' stories. Their accounts of childhood suffering are also open to the public on the Royal Commission's website. One survivor wrote of his continuing trauma. In 1978, a little boy started crying. In 2014, he still is. Following the Commission's five-year investigation, 2,500 cases of abuse were handed to Australian authorities and scores of prosecutions are underway. In August, the Catholic Church in Australia formally rejected one of the inquiry's key recommendations that priests should be forced to report sexual abuse disclosed during confession. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Bangladesh's Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina says that there are more than 1 million Rohingya refugees living in Bangladesh. Among the Muslim-majority ethnic group, there are approximately 450 Hindus living in the city of Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. VOA's Muazzam Hussein Shakil visited these Hindus as they were observing their first-ever Hindu festival called Durga Puja and filed this report narrated by Benzan Hamdar.
With the help of the Bangladesh government, approximately 450 Rohingya Hindus celebrated their first-ever Durga Puja in Bangladesh. Durga Puja is a Hindu festival that marks the victory of the goddess Durga in a battle with an evil demon. According to the Rohingya Hindus, they have never been able to publicly celebrate Durga Puja due to the restrictions imposed on them by the Myanmar government.
I haven't performed Durga Puja for the last 10 years and I have never been to celebrate in front of Fatima. It is really great to celebrate in Bangladesh. I'm very happy.
We would celebrate at home privately without Fatima. We couldn't do it publicly.
Thousands of Bengali Hindus celebrated the colorful Durga Puja festival all across Bangladesh and in Cox's Bazar. Rohingya Hindus were also treated to a special ceremony orchestrated by the Bangladesh government. Local governments provided security and some local government officials attended the celebration.
Evil power pushes these Rohingyas from their own country. They are eager to go back because they're suffering in the camps. The government is trying to help them to return without any problems.
Rohingya Hindus are hopeful that one day they will be able to celebrate Durga Puja in their homeland freely. For Muazzam Hussain Shakil in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, this is Behzad Hamdard, VOA News.
As another World Polio Day comes around, the World Health Organization reports three polio endemic countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria, hold the key to the global eradication of this crippling disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
About 500,000 children were becoming paralyzed by polio every year when the World Health Organization began its global polio eradication campaign 3 decades ago. Today, that number has been reduced by more than 99%. WHO reports fewer than 30 cases of the disease this year, many of them in countries that had been considered polio-free. Spokesman for the Polio Eradication Initiative, Oliver Rosenbauer, tells VOA outbreaks have occurred in Niger, Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Kenya, and Papua New Guinea.
This really, really underscores the risk that we have this disease, that it will continue to reappear, reemerge in areas that had already eradicated this disease. We've seen this time and again. It's not the first time that we're facing new outbreaks again, and we're confident, we know what it takes to stop these outbreaks again.
Rosenbauer says these countries are implementing emergency measures to stop the outbreak, but he warns the risk of the wild polio virus spreading across borders will continue until the disease is eradicated in the three endemic states of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria.
These three countries hold the key to a polio-free world, and they have been battling this disease so very long, but they're making actually tremendous progress this year. Never before have we seen the disease in these countries at such low levels as we are today, this year.
Rosenbauer says Afghanistan and Pakistan have each reported 6 cases of polio. He says no cases of the paralytic disease have been detected in Nigeria, but that, he says, does not mean there are no new cases of the disease there. He notes the wild polio virus is present in parts of Borno State in northeastern Nigeria, which are under the control of Boko Haram militant Islamists. This, he says, makes it too dangerous for health workers to conduct disease surveillance to see whether the virus is circulating. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Afghan women, too many times, have been seen by some as victims, victims of domestic violence, cultural limitations, political restrictions, and more. Their voices often go unheard, but not in a play produced in Washington, D.C. called Women of Troy, Voices from Afghanistan. It's a story of Afghan women's bravery and resilience told through music and poetry. Narration by VOA's Zila Nouri brings us more.
My name is Poseidon, God of antiquity.
The Kennedy Center for Performing Arts in Washington presented a limited run of Women of Troy, Voices from Afghanistan, a collaboration between Afghan and American artists.
I think the message is learning about Afghanistan, the many layers of the people, especially the women, goes very deep and very far back into history. And I hope everyone will get a much better understanding of Afghanistan.
Don't mock me! I feel things! I love, I hate!
Oh my, I've never known a god switch so quickly from love to hate!
It's a retelling of an anti-war play, Trojan Women, by the ancient Greek playwright Euripides. The twist? The Alliance for New Music Theater sets the story in modern-day Afghanistan, dedicated to Afghan women. Music plays a crucial role in the play, with a unique combination of cello plus Afghanistan's national instrument, rabab, and the percussive tabla. Singer and actress Jennifer Lee spent 6 months in rehearsals and says she's formed a special bond with the character she plays.
I think it was just so wonderful because it shows the unity that women across the world, we share the same plight. And I think that's so great that I was able to really capture the character of Hecuba and capture the mood of the plight of Afghanistan women.
Choreographer Liza Ahmadi thinks now is the time for the world to see the true Afghan women.
We have roots of creativity, roots of all kinds of cultures and ethnicities inside of us. And right now, the way that Afghan women and Afghans in general are presented is in a very, very flat one image. And in fact, we're incredibly complex, incredibly intelligent society.
The play's co-author Yelda Bakhtash wanted to break any stereotypes held by Westerners about Afghan women. Bakhtash hopes that through these characters, a more realistic picture of Afghan women emerges.
The perception of Afghan women in the West is that they are weak and unable to deal with difficulties. But I decided to display a different view of Afghan women, and for this reason, I tried to write about characters with abilities, achievers in Afghan history.
Audience member Mariam Jalali said it was refreshing to see the portrayal of an Afghan woman by an American.
An American woman was playing an Afghan woman and showcasing a scene in the life of an Afghan woman. That was very interesting to see.
The message of this reboot of the Greek play written in 415 BC is that Afghan women have been an integral part of their own society, both brave and strong, much like the women of Troy. For Gilan Nuri in Washington, D.C., this is Behzhan Hamdard, VOA News.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, food in the United States can be quite varied as you travel through different regions. In one West Virginia town, the food itself and how it became available might be considered quite unusual. First, we're talking about delicacies such as spicy bear and deer stew, rich turtle soup, alligator gumbo, possum, and elk. The main ingredients are roadkill, animals killed along the local highways by passing cars. Evgeny Baranov attended this event and tried some of the unique offerings. Anna Rice serves the tales.
Marland in West Virginia is home to about 1,000 residents and one famous cook-off, the Roadkill Cook-Off. For more than 25 years, chefs and meat lovers have been flocking to the town to cook up or eat up black bear, possum, elk, snapping turtle, and even reptiles.
The name of our team is You Hit 'Em, We Spit 'Em, like on a spit to cook something. It's called Hillbilly Mardi Gras Alligator and Turtle Gumbo over Country Creamy Grits or Creamy Country Grits.
We are making a predator prey chili with bear meat and venison, which is deer meat.
It's a neat place to try a new kind of food. I mean, you don't get alligator every day. You don't get bear every day.
But even the Roadkill Cook-Off's main cheerleader and organizer still has concerns about food safety and how the roadkill is handled.
Unless it's taken away, like, immediately within minutes after it's killed, if not, the meat gets poisoned because the sedatives go through their body. So once they're hit along the road, 5 minutes later, they're probably no good.
Roadkill aficionados point out that there are ways to ensure the meat is safe to eat. And they argue since the animals are dead, it's wasteful not to serve them up as food. Half of U.S. states have laws that allow people to pick up and cook animals hit and killed by vehicles.
We can't control the wildlife and keep it from getting hurt when we drive on the roads, but we try to make use of what we have.
But not all events at the festival are so controversial. Downtown Marlington is blocked off for the day, and tourists can wander the main streets where vendors sell locally handcrafted items, and an old-timey country fair is in full swing.
The Autumn Harvest Festival is one of those nice festivals where we get to celebrate the arts and crafts of our community.
And if it helps celebrate the rustic and sometimes rugged culture of West Virginia, it's a tradition the locals plan to continue. For Evgeny Baranov in Marlington, West Virginia, I'm Anna Rice, VOA News.
The Syrian government says the ancient city of Palmyra, gravely damaged by Islamic State militants, could reopen to the public next spring. But while restoration continues on the ground, one French tech startup is showing people how Palmyra and other cities affected by war once looked, how they look now, and how they might look after restoration. An explanation from VOA's Kevin Enox.
This is the Syrian city of Aleppo, after it was damaged by fighting during the civil war. And this is the Al-Nuri Mosque in Mosul, Iraq, also damaged by fighting. And this is how it looked once upon a time, and perhaps could again. This imagery, courtesy of a small French startup called Iconum, is showing not only the devastation of some of the world's historic places, but also providing images of the same places undamaged by time in war.
De prise de vue, hein, des appareils photo, des drones. On prend des centaines.
We take hundreds of thousands of photos that we bring back to France to process using large computers, and these algorithms will automatically construct photorealistic 3D models, true copies of the real sites, but virtual.
To get those photos, the teams visit sites like this one in Palmyra, armed with cameras, then let their algorithms do the rest.
This 3D model that we're in the process of generating will help to make the general map of the land register, which will allow architects to see the city, which monuments we will be able to keep, and which we can restore, and which strategy we will adopt for the future reconstruction.
Some of the team's work is currently on display in Paris, and for many people, it's a sobering affair.
Sadness. I feel sadness because I visited Leptis Magna and Aleppo before the bombings, and it is gut-wrenching, really, because it was a very beautiful city, well-preserved, with a real life to it, and to see that is saddening.
Iconum has teamed up with the UN to help its efforts to preserve and restore places like Mosul, Aleppo, and Palmyra. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Two Chinese golfers have pulled out of the U.S. Women's Golf Tournament in Taiwan without explanation, an apparent sign of lingering political tensions between Taiwan and China. The LPGA's Swinging Skirts Taiwan Championship got underway on Thursday without world number 9, formerly number 1 ranked Shan San Feng, and rookie Yu Liu, leaving the competition without any Chinese players. Relations between Taiwan, viewed by Beijing as a renegade province, and China have worsened since the 2016 election victory of President Tsai Ing-wen and her independence-leaning Democratic Progressive Party. Liu told Reuters via her Weibo social media account she was told she could not respond regarding the issue of withdrawing from the competition. Quan Kuo is a reporter for the Golf Channel's China program. He told VOA's Victor Beatty most likely the reason behind the sudden withdrawal was political.
I think enough on the tournament where, for example, this year at the Players' Championship, where C.D. Pan from Taiwan was playing in it, and his caddy bib shows the Taiwanese flag. The rights holder, Aichi, actually requested the PGA Tour to take it down, and it was a little tense moment there.
You said this happens frequently?
Oh, yeah. When I caddy at the U.S. Open back in 2012, and it was Taiwanese flag, and again, it was being complained, and they had been removed and put on the Olympic flags. So it happened all the time.
These two women, their withdrawal will be a big blow to this tournament.
Yes, indeed. Unfortunately, golf got the political involvement there.
So you're saying this is purely political. No reason's been given.
As you can say, there's no statement about Feng Shanshan or Liu Yu being injured, and that's purely political.
In July, the Taiwan city of Taichung lost the right to host the first East Asia Youth Games in 2019. Is that also political?
I would suspect so, yes.
What will be the impact on the upcoming 2020 Tokyo Olympics? As you know, there is some question about whether Taiwan as an island should compete as Taiwan or the current formulation of Chinese Taipei.
Well, unfortunately, this is the issue that I think both countries, in my opinion, they need to work it out. And at this point in time, China is really exercising muscle right now to suppress Taiwan. I think mainly because the current government in Taiwan are more towards into the so-called Taiwanese independence. And I think that's pretty much that what all these things coming about.
Do you anticipate that politics will play a larger role as long as China and Taiwan are involved?
I believe so. I think maybe not. I think once it gets to a certain point that when the middle class in China has a more say about their system and they change from within, and perhaps they will understand.
So you have some hope?
Oh, always hope. Yes, yes, indeed. I mean, obviously, this is two separate countries, but China doesn't consider Taiwan as an independent country, but they run their own governments and on elections. So there's always hope that somehow this two countries will resolve this in the future.
Quan Quo said there has been declining official enthusiasm for golf in China, with golf courses being closed, underscoring the official view that golf is more of an elite activity rather than a sport, so that the people would get the impression the government is for the common man, not the rich. He said the future of golf in China is up to the growing middle class and its demands for greater leisure activities. You've been listening to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please join us again next week and stay informed at all times by checking into our website at voanews.com. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia.